www.ebay.com/store.
No hate, no hype, no fear. We are TFFR. Frequency Radio.
Waking up to ash and dust, I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing in the chemicals. I'm breaking in, shaping up, then checking out on the prison bus. This is it, the apocalypse. Whoa, I'm waking up.
Hello, hello. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my gosh. It's Wednesday. We've done it again. It is the 11th day of March. Congratulations. It's halfway through the week. We're going to get through it. I promise. It's all going to happen. My name's JD. We're live right now. Thank you, guys, in the chat room. This is, of course, the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast. Today, as I said, Wednesday, the 11th day of March. And today is going to be a very big show, ladies and gentlemen. We have got a guest. Illusion. Unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen, how good this is. And I'll tell you what, I have got hundreds of hours into 9/11 research, and I learned something because Rebecca Roth brings a unique perspective to the entire 9/11 investigation. Really fundamentally, I don't want to give too much away, but she's a career flight attendant, has been for almost 30 years. And oh, man, we're dropping audio. I'll see what I can do. Let me disconnect and reconnect here real fast, guys. Oh, is it back up? Okay, never mind. We're good. Everybody's good. And there was much rejoicing. Anyway, Rebecca Roth will be joining us on the program here in about an hour. Very much looking forward to having her come and enlighten all of you guys about 9/11. Again, just a topic that to me was really the gateway through to opening up, to understanding what exactly is going on in the world. And so, to me, it's a topic that just needs to be brought up over and over and over and over again. So anyway, Rebecca Roth, she's written a fantastic book. She's going to be our guest here in about an hour. And I do really highly recommend that you guys get pens and paper ready, because you will learn things about 9/11 today that you did not know before. And that is the name of the game here at Red Pill Reports, is to try and bring you guys the newest information as soon as it hits the street. I'm telling you right now, this book, Methodical Illusion, probably is going to be made into a movie. She's got a lot of trouble keeping these things in stock right now, and I can see why. I can see why after reading. I blew through this thing in like 6 hours, guys. This is how good this is. I couldn't put it down. So anyway, big show today, 9/11, back in the spotlight, and we're going to learn some stuff today. So I'm very, very excited to have you guys all joining us for that. Moving back into, tomorrow's show, Chris and Sherry Geo are going to be joining us. I have no idea what we're going to talk about, so we'll have to talk to them a little bit later and figure that out. But no matter what it is, I'm sure it's going to be awesome. Chris and Sherry Geo obviously are the network managers here at Truth Frequency, and they have done so much to make this network as just absolutely amazing as it can possibly be. There are new hosts joining the network all the time. Absolutely am thrilled to be part of the family and the support that the hosts show one another here. It's like no other place in the world, ladies and gentlemen. There is not another network in which the hosts all act as a team. It just doesn't exist. So really, really excited to be a part of all of these guys. And Chris and Sherry Geo will be joining us tomorrow. Okay, that's probably enough for the morning. I hope wherever you guys are at, it is nice outside. The weather here is absolutely stunning outside, just beautiful blue skies. It's going to be in the 70s today, so I think we finally hit that springtime run, and I'm excited about that too. Okay, let's jump on. Appreciate all you guys supporting True Frequency. Really appreciate you guys supporting Red Pill Reports also. And just for new listeners out there, we go over the news, everything that's pertinent from around the world for the first hour. You can find all of the articles that we're going to go over at redpillreports.com in the show/guest section there at the top of the page. You can also find there at the top of the page The links to all of Greg Morse's information, all of the mortgage scandal stuff. We're still really encouraging people sign his petition so we can get this joint session in front of Congress together and actually expose some of these people. But anyway, that's my diatribe for the morning. Let's get into some news because there is a lot of stuff going on around the world. We talked a little bit yesterday about the arrest of the alleged shooter of Boris Nemtsov there in Russia and how essentially the administration there had come out and said, well, they believe that there was some kind of link or this the actual guy, what's his name here, Dadyev, I think is his name, said, you know, in the initial interrogation that it was because Nemtsov had made some negative comments about Muslim and Muhammad or whatever. And so most of the opposition said that seems pretty thin. So there's been a little bit more research going into this story, and it has now come out that there is CCTV footage that shows the car that was used in this murder essentially around Boris Nemtsov's compound, his home there, for weeks and weeks before the Charlie Hebdo shooting actually happened. And that's important because really the Charlie Hebdo shooting was the only time in which Nemtsov had ever really said anything at all revolving around, you know, the Muslim religion or anything like that. So the fact that these guys had kind of been or allegedly had been kind of casing Boris Nemtsov his home for weeks and weeks prior to the Charlie Hebdo incident just kind of makes you – it just makes it more skeptical that this was that those issues were related. Again, Nemtsov was shot dead in Moscow on a bridge overlooking the Kremlin on the 27th of February. He's always been a fierce critic of Vladimir Putin. So anyway, I think – well, first of all, I think the Charlie Hebdo thing was an inside job or some kind of staged event, you know, seeing the videos – of the police officer not being shot to death in the street, plus the guys on the roof with the flak jackets on, just kind of makes you wonder what in the hell was going on. And so, you know, probably to me, it's just another false flag to get all the fear ramped up. But I think this this investigation into the Nemtsov killing is going to be a snow job for sure. They're going to do everything they can to try and blame this on, you know, radical Islam or something like that, when really it's most likely that it was a false flag carried out by, you know, the United States or Mossad or CIA or somebody to really rile up, destabilize the people. I mean, that's part of how we do this. That's the whole concept of destabilizing a nation and going in and trying to overthrow the regime. There's a new article out today suggesting that Obama wants to overthrow Putin and replace his regime with somebody better. Of course, that's what they're trying to do. I mean, that's how it goes. So anyway, more news out of Russia. Moscow announced yesterday that it is completely ending activities under the Treaty on Conventional Armed Forces in Europe. Russia's participation in the treaty was first halted back in 2007. So a statement from the foreign ministry said that the Russian Federation has taken the decision to halt its participation in meetings of the consulting group from March 11th. So as of today, Russia is ending its actions on the Treaty of Conventional Armed Forces in Europe, which was announced in 2007. It is completely doing it as of today. So Moscow had asked Belarus to represent Russian interests in the group starting from today, as I said, March 11th. And according to the ministry, the move does not mean that Moscow refuses to continue further dialogue on control of conventional armed forces in Europe if and when the partners are ready for it, according to the ministry official. He also added that future work on the project should serve the interest of both Russia and the United States. So what does this all mean? Well, the original CFE treaty was signed in 1990 by 16 NATO and 6 Warsaw Pacts. Okay, it set equal ceilings for each bloc on a key category of conventional armaments with tanks, combat armored vehicles, artillery, assault helicopters, et cetera, et cetera. For instance, under the treaty, each side is supposed to have no more than 16,500 tanks, or we'll say 27,300 armored combat vehicles in active units. Okay, so essentially, 1999 saw an adapted version of the treaty that was signed. However, the NATO members refused to ratify it until Russia withdrew troops from Georgia and the breakaway Moldavian region of Transnistria. Russia slammed the condition as being what they termed at the time as an artificial linkage. Anyway, in 2007, this led to Moscow imposing a moratorium on the treaty altogether. Moscow said that the treaty was irrelevant since NATO planned on increasing its military presence in Eastern Europe. 4 years later, the North Atlantic bloc stated exchange of information on conventional weapons and troops with Russia would be stopped. In November of 2014, Moscow suspended the implementation of CFE treaty, 2 months later, the U.S. House of Representatives issued a resolution condemning Russia and other points, urging President Obama to review U.S. and NATO armed forces readiness under the CFE. So, again, Moscow says on Tuesday, for many years, the Russian Federation has been doing everything possible to maintain the treaty, initiated talks on its adaption, and ratified the adaption agreement. Again, this is coming out of Moscow. Meanwhile, Norway has started military exercises on its northernmost province, which borders Russia's Kola Peninsula. That initiative is called Joint Viking. It's a one-week war game involving 5,000 Norwegian troops and 400 vehicles. I think we talked about this a couple of days ago. The largest military training exercise in nearly 50 years in Norway. Again, also been promoting closer military cooperation with NATO member states after the escalation of the Ukraine crisis. So again, Russia essentially right now, long story short, is saying that they don't care about caps on, you know, how many weapons they're allowed to have, because NATO obviously is completely surrounding them. You know, we've got all these, what are we going to call those things? Oh, what are we calling them? Lost my mind. Exercises. We've got all these exercises going all around. You got Operation, you know, Viking and Total Resolve and all this stuff that's operating right there on Russia's borders. Of course they're going to end these. Why would they continue to try and stick to a treaty that doesn't make any sense? Here's something that makes a lot of sense, actually, and I think this is a pretty good story. The Palestinian Authority arrested about 50 militant Islamists in the West Bank just this week. With the Israeli elections about a week away, Mohammed Abbas administrations, they were fearing that any kind of terror attack could actually propel Netanyahu's Likud party back into power. So, in a preemptive move, the Palestinian Authority went ahead and rounded up about 50 militant Islamists in the West Bank before the 17th election there in Israel. So, again, security forces from the Palestinian Authority rounded up 50 guys, and they all belong to Hamas or the Islamic Jihad in the West Bank over the last couple of days. And so they're doing it, again, because they don't want anybody that isn't under control of the actual Palestinian Authority, a.k.a. Hamas, to go and do something stupid and rile up the people of Israel and essentially put a bunch of, you know, oxygen on the stoking fire that is underneath Netanyahu right now. He's not doing that great. Again, we had about 30,000 people over the weekend. New estimates have come out said that there were about 50,000 people in Tel Aviv who were protesting the prime minister there, Netanyahu. So again, kind of a tenuous situation right now. And I like this. I like the fact that the Palestinian Authority took it upon themselves to preemptively try and keep anything bad from happening. Because again, the Palestinian Authority understands that if Netanyahu wins this election again and the Knesset takes over, the likelihood that they are going to be recognized as a state pretty much becomes impossible going into the future. I mean, we're talking minimal. Possibility for that. So I really do, again, you know, say what you will about the Palestinian Authority. Obviously, Hamas does not represent everything that's going on in Gaza right now. And good for the Palestinian Authority trying to keep things peaceful. I like that. Let's move back into Paris here for just a second. There were four people arrested, including a police officer who worked at the Police Intelligence Center. They are all being held right now over alleged links to Amidi Coulibaly, who was the kosher deli hostage taker who killed five people during the terror attacks in Paris earlier this year. The suspects are being questioned as part of an ongoing investigation into the January attacks, including the massacre at the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which obviously claimed 17 lives over the course of 3 days. The policewoman, who is identified only as Emmanuel, is among the suspects, according to French media. The woman, who converted to Islam 2 years ago, unbeknownst to her supervisors, was stationed at a high-security police intelligence headquarters in the eastern suburb of Paris at the time of the attacks. And Emmanuel allegedly switched her police cap for an Islamic headscarf when leaving work. Sources close to the investigation say there is no evidence directly linking her to the Jewish deli attack. But in the aftermath of the massacre, Emmanuel allegedly consulted computer files on her boyfriend, Amar R., who is one of the other four currently being questioned right now. And the woman was reportedly trying to find out how much information the authorities had on her boyfriend, who is believed to be a relative of Coulibaly. So Emmanuel, again, suspended from her duties at the end of last month, according to Le Figaro. Amar R. was seen near the kosher supermarket and in the company of Coulibaly in the lead up to the January 9 attack. He was arrested on the 23rd of January under a European arrest warrant issued by Spain for drug trafficking and arms smuggling. However, he had not been questioned about the Paris attacks until now, and details of the other two suspects not released. But inside job, evidence more, again, of an inside job. They've arrested a policewoman who's working at an intelligence center there while all this stuff was going on, and she had access to the records, intelligence records, on Kalibali and the boyfriend. And, I mean, hello, inside job. Just saying. Oh, let's see here. Don't care about that. I do want to talk about Venezuela today. We're going to talk about a little bit about Obama and this whole thing that he threw down the gauntlet earlier this week. So ever since the advent of the Cold War, the United States officials have told us that it was necessary for the United States to adapt the totalitarian structure known as the national security state in order to combat communist totalitarianism, right? So now we are witnessing a similar spectacle with respect to President Obama's exercise of dictatorial powers to deal with the socialist regime of President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. Obama's justification for his embrace of these dictatorial powers would undoubtedly be the same as that of the Cold War, the old Cold Warriors, that in order to combat the dictatorial powers of Maduro, it has become necessary for Obama himself to assume and exercise dictatorial powers here in the United States. So yesterday, President Obama issued an executive order declaring the Venezuelan government, quote unquote, an extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States. That's what he said. They are an extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States, according to the New York Times. And this was part of his executive order in which Obama froze the American assets and various Venezuelan law enforcement and military officials here, right? Imagine that, an extraordinary threat to national security. What is the exact nature of this extraordinary threat to national security? According to the New York Times, the Obama administration said in his statement that we are deeply concerned by the Venezuelan government's effort to escalate intimidation of its political opponents. What? What? How in the world does Venezuelan's government's intimidation of political opponents constitute a grave threat to the national security of the United States? That does not make any sense whatsoever. Is Obama saying that Maduro might begin intimidating the U.S. Congress or the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Or is he saying that Maduro's socialist philosophy might spread to the United States and result in an even bigger expansion of Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare and other socialist programs here at home? Or is he saying that Maduro might mobilize his army, begin sweeping up to Central America and up through Mexico with the aim of invading and conquering the United States and taking over the public schools, the IRS, Social Security, and the interstate highway system and other socialist institutions here in the United States? I suppose that in the long history of the United U.S. national security state since 1947, there probably have been more ridiculous notions regarding so-called threats to national security, but this newest one has got to rank up in at least the top five of the most ridiculous. So Obama justifies his arbitrary seizure of these assets belonging to Venezuelan officials by claiming that such officials have links to human rights violations in Venezuela. Really? How does Obama know that these people whose property he seized are guilty? Did he file a legal action, either civil or criminal, against these officials for seizing his property? Did he produce any kind of competent evidence in a court of law establishing that they were guilty of violating the law? Did he secure a court order authorizing the asset seizure? Or did he provide argument to a U.S. judge as to why the U.S. empire has jurisdiction to enforce the laws of Venezuela? Did he provide a notice and hearing and other aspects of due process of law to the people whose property he just seized, enabling to defend themselves against his actions in a court of law? Did he even go to Congress to seek authorization for this extraordinary action? The answer is no. Obama did not do any of these things. Instead, in the battle against his personal nemesis, Nicolas Maduro, he has adopted and exercised the same type of dictatorial powers embraced and exercised by Maduro and, for that matter, other Latin American dictators. No legislative authorization, no judicial approval, no due process of law, just raw dictatorial power manifested by a decree that has no difference from decrees issued by totalitarian dictatorships. Okay, so responding to Obama's dictatorial action, Cabello, who is the Venezuelan National Assembly Speaker, said, "We are a great threat to the United States. What is being planned are attacks against our land, against our country, and military attacks against our soil." And Cabello might have a point. After all, the U.S. national security state does have a long history of targeting socialist regimes in Latin America whose rulers refuse to kowtow to the U.S. empire with regime change, including ones where the country's presidents have been democratically elected. Places like Guatemala come to mind, or Grenada, Panama, Chile, Nicaragua, Cuba, Brazil. Did I get them all? Well, and now Venezuela. So is this what we want for America? Is this what we're doing here? Dictatorship in the name of combating dictatorship? It's bad enough that Venezuelans have this experience in, you know, in their own country, but why make it worse by having Americans experience the exact same thing? Let's see here. Okay. Everybody sound okay? Are we sounding okay out there? Oregon, Eric, are you saying that the sound sounds muffled? What's going on here? Okay, I'm just double checking on the sound here, guys. Anyway, let's get over to what Maduro had to say about all this, because it's pretty interesting. Here's a little interesting tidbit, too. If you just stop and think about it for a second, Maduro is probably the closest ideological peer in the world to President Obama, really. I mean, fundamentally, from a socialist standpoint, they're two peas from the same pod, right? Anyway, Maduro came back, called the sanctioned officials heroes. President Barack Obama, representing the U.S. imperialistic elite, has personally decided to take it on task of defeating my government and intervening in Venezuela to control it, Maduro said in a national TV address, which is why he took more measures yesterday. Maduro called the move by the United States a colossal mistake and imperialistic arrogance, similar to that of former U.S. leaders such as Richard Nixon and George W. Bush. But he does go on to say that he congratulates them, says that it's an honor to be included on the U.S. sanction list. He even named one of the sanctioned officials, National Intelligence Head Gustavo Gonzalez, to the new Interior Ministry position. So the biggest punchline, though, really, is the Venezuelan ruler will now use the Obama executive order precisely as a catalyst to grant himself even more powers, because as Bloomberg suggests, today Maduro will request passage of an anti-imperialistic enabling law. So he says now he has put together a special law that gives him special powers to preserve the peace, the integrity, and the sovereignty of the country before any situation that presents itself due to this imperialistic aggression. So he said that yesterday on television. Again, he wants to use special and extraordinary enabling law to defend the peace, the sovereignty, the tranquility, and the integrity of the homeland. So he is apparently, I don't know what the plan is yet. I guess we'll have to wait until that says that comes out until that comes out today. Also, just as a side note, there's another country called Cuba who came out in the AP yesterday, and this is what their little blurb said: unconditional support for Venezuela. Cuba says unconditional support for Venezuela. So I'll tell you what, we are digging a hole. We are digging a hole, ladies and gentlemen. I got to talk about this story, too. So there's been a lot of talk about charges. This is interesting. There's been a lot of talk about charges being brought against former President George W. Bush, former Vice President Dick Cheney, and others in his administration, like Donald Rumsfeld. And some of the reports about nations like Germany bringing war crime charges against members of the Bush administration have been very greatly exaggerated. But they are actually touching on a very real push in Europe to hold them accountable for the CIA torture and other human rights violations committed in the name of the so-called war on terror. Unfortunately, some of the misleading headlines suggesting that Germany is in fact already charging George Bush and crew aren't exactly what is happening yet. Instead, what is happening right now is that the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights has been making the case for heavyweight members of the EU to bring war crime charges against members of the former administration. This has prompted some sites to misleadingly say that Germany is filing charges against George W. Bush, but we're not quite there yet. And the chances of these nations actually trying to prosecute, you know, George and Cheney and company are pretty slim. But there was a statement released yesterday by the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights again, and they're making a pretty powerful case right now. So it comes down to Germany. Why Germany? Well, the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights is making the case to Germany that the United States violated the internationally recognized human rights of the German citizen Khalid El-Masri. El-Masri had been kidnapped by the CIA agents back in 2004, okay? Again, El-Masri kidnapped by CIA agents back in 2004. He was a German citizen. So what exactly did he do? Nothing. No, really, he didn't do anything. It was all a case of mistaken identity. But because of that CIA error, he was tortured in a secret CIA interrogation facility in Afghanistan. So Wolfgang Kallak, who, again, is a representative of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, he's actually their general secretary, he said that by investigating members of the Bush administration, Germany can now ensure that those responsible for the abduction, abuse, and illegal detention do not go unpunished. Again, what's important to understand here is that these torture memos didn't just appear independently from the Justice Department. Okay, these memos were facilitated by the very people, Bush, Cheney, Rummy, etc., who were believed to be, we believe, should be indicted. This is, again, the Center for Constitutional and Human Rights people speaking here. This was part of a conspiracy so they could get away with torture, and that's not really what the subject is right now. The subject here, whatever we think of these memos, is that they're useless in Europe. Europe does not accept this, quote, golden shield of a legal defense. Either it is torture or it is not. Either you did it or you did not. And that is one of the reasons, among others, why they're going to Europe and why they want Europe to bring these charges against Bush and Cheney et al. So the whole premise here, again, is that El-Masri supports the push for prosecution because this is Germany. Whatever happened before between the NSA spying on Germany and the fact of the matter is that one of their citizens has been now revealed to be kept in a torture facility when it was known that he was innocent. So Germany has to take that seriously. I mean, that's torture. We essentially, a foreign government kidnapped one of their citizens, took him to Afghanistan, knew that the man was innocent, and tortured him anyway. So you don't have a much more definitive example of war crimes, in my opinion. So hopefully some movement will happen there. There's a lot of conjecture about things going on kind of behind the scenes with these guys already these days. So I don't know. I'm going to go over to the chat room. When we discuss economic move, BDI down by 3 to 565. Massive cargo ship, Oscar, didn't see that. Oh, 19,000 container, blah, 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 blah. Empty cargo ship, crazy. I did see a big shipping ship that was shipping ships the other day. Figure that out. It was on YouTube. It was crazy. It was a big shipping ship that was shipping ships, and it was back to the hill. Crazy town. Anyway, we got to go to a 3-minute break, you guys. When we come back, we have plenty more news to cover. And please, honestly, stay here. You are not going to want to miss Rebecca Roth. We are going to have a 9/11 discussion to end all 9/11 discussions today. She put all of the puzzle pieces together, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you guys for being in the chat and supporting Radio. We got a 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
A sudden change in the wind. The day grows dark. As ominous clouds move in and lightning begins to carve arcs in the sky, and you realize you are not prepared.
I'm telling you, take cover.
The number of intense storms is increasing exponentially in the U.S. Tornadoes, hurricanes, flooding, and droughts are happening with greater magnitude and frequency. If you are choosing to rely on the government to save you,
and no one's coming to help them,
you could be dead wrong. The first step towards self-reliance in the face of disaster is a visit to My Patriot Supply. There you'll find the absolute best prices on storable foods, non-GMO seeds, emergency water filtration devices, and so much more. All orders over $49 qualify for free shipping in the lower 48. Visit us online or call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. And speak to one of our preparedness advisors today. Remember, before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com. Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help
people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at hempusa.org.
Within Radio with Tom Barnes and Tommy Woodgate. Saturdays on True Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys so much for sticking with us. We got a 3-minute break. Thank all of you guys in the chat room. No wood. It is not raining here right now. It is absolutely pristinely beautiful outside right now, and we are not going to talk about motorcycles. We're just not going to talk about them right now. So, no, it would be awful to be out on a motorcycle right now. So I feel sorry for anybody out enjoying the weather. Anyway, appreciate all you guys sticking with us. Appreciate you guys all being here. Let's get into some national news here real quick. Obviously, Hillary Clinton, this whole email scandal, big time, going to be in the news for a while right now. But Trey Gowdy had some stuff to say about this. Apparently, you know, he's obviously the chairman of the Benghazi committee looking into what actually happened at Benghazi. He said that although Clinton had provided 50,000 pages of emails, documents from her trips to Libya following the terrorist attacks were not included. So, again, Trey Gowdy saying he's gotten 50,000 pages of emails from Ms. Clinton, but documentation from her trip to Libya following the terrorist attacks, not included in that. So Gowdy appeared on CBS's Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer on Sunday, and he confirmed that there were huge gaps in the email records that were given to the Benghazi committee. Gowdy said that while Clinton's emails are still under investigation, there would be no selective releases of the messages. He says if she wants to release them all, with the emphasis being on the word all, she is welcome to do that. I can't stop her from doing that, but serious investigations don't make selective releases. And he goes on to say there are gaps of months and months and months. And if you think that the iconic picture on the C-17 of her flying to Libya, her being Mrs. Hillary Clinton there, I'll tell you, that's her, I think that's her Twitter picture right now, too. If I was her, I would change that picture. Again, you can see that iconic picture. She's on the C-17. She's flying to Libya. She's got her sunglasses on, and she's got her BlackBerry in her hand. He says, we have no emails from that day. In fact, we have no emails from that trip at all. So, again, the fact that she had all these, the private server crammed in her closet at home, that she has now come out. Yesterday, she came out and actually did a news conference about this on Tuesday. She was at the United Nations. She had delivered a scheduled speech about women's rights, but then she basically took an aside note and spent about 15 minutes, very brief, talking about these emails. And she said she would be releasing all of the emails for everyone to see. But she did acknowledge that she deleted messages related to personal matters. Ooh, personal matters. And she also refused calls from Republicans to turn over the email server itself that she kept at her home to an independent reviewer. So, again, not going to be turning over the server to Homeland Security or whoever is in charge of this investigation. Also, as a side note, now that the State Department is beginning to sort through more than 50,000 pages of these emails from Hillary Clinton that she handed over last year, she's going to be sticking taxpayers with the additional cost, because this additional cost of doing all of these, they're talking about hundreds of thousands of man hours that they're going to have to use to actually start going through individually all of these emails. Could reach into the millions of dollars. It could cost us. And again, where's that money coming from? It's coming out of our pocket. So not only did she decide that she wanted to have this homebrew server rather than the government account to conduct her official business, she also tweeted last week that she wants the State Department to release her emails, but she has not acknowledged what a huge job that will be for her former employees. So on March 5th, Secretary of State John Kerry pledged that the department would work as rapidly as possible to go through all of the new documents, redact any sensitive information, and then release them to the public. The department has also said that it will probably take several months for this to go through. Representative Mike Pompeo, who is a member of the House Special Committee on Benghazi that is subpoenaing Clinton's personal emails, told us, based on his committee's experience of sorting through the 44,000 other hard copy paper documents provided by the State Department last year, the new effort could involve hundreds of thousands of man hours. I officially hate USA time. What's USA time, Kev? Anyway, it's going to cost us a ridiculous amount of money to go through all these emails now. Speaking also of ridiculous amount of money, the Obama family, 2014 Christmas vacation in Hawaii. Take a wild stab how much that cost us. I'll tell you, $3.6 million, but that was just transportation expenses. That's just the airline travel. $3.6 million, just an airline travel. Sounds like a good job if you could get it. A Texas judge who placed an injunction against President Barack Obama's controversial executive orders on immigration dismissed this week a request by the White House to stay his order while the situation unfolds in court. Of course, the administration – oh, I had daylight savings. Yeah, it's stupid. I hate it, too. It messes up my whole everything. Anyway, so – essentially, the administration here was hoping that even though this injunction has been filed against Barack Obama's non-signed executive nudge that he gave to Jay over at the Homeland Security, this obviously the judge in Texas put an injunction on it, making sure that the Border Patrol people aren't following that directive. But Barack Obama asked the judge to go ahead and dismiss that injunction. That Texas judge said, no, thanks. His name is U.S. District Court Judge Andrew Hannon. He said he will not rule just yet on a request to unblock his order against President Obama's immigration plan. As justification, he referred to allegations that the White House misled Texas and 25 other states that filed a lawsuit against the executive orders. Last week, the Justice Department told the judge that it had granted approximately 100,000 undocumented immigrants 3-year work permits between November 24th and February 16th, when the executive orders were blocked by Hannon. According to the states, however, the federal government said it was not going to start acting on Obama's orders until February of 2015. So even though the administration said they weren't going to actually enact these non-signed executive orders until the February 15th, they actually started in November or late November and carried all the way through February 16th when this injunction came down. So for its part, the government stated that the immigrants in question did qualify for the 2012 Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which was not stopped by Hannon's order. But under the 2012, however, those who qualified would be granted 2-year permits, not 3-year permits, which is what has happened. So again, lots of goofiness going on still with this whole immigration policy change. Some more news coming out of Washington State right now. The U.S. Secret Service is set to carry out secret drone flights over Washington over the next few weeks. They are working on a covert plan, a covert government program to find ways to counter rogue drones that could threaten sensitive buildings. Obviously, they're concerned because, a medium-sized drone could probably be packed with some sort of biological weapon or explosive or something like that. So what they're essentially going to be doing right now is they're going to be flying their own drones around trying to jam signals and see if they can disrupt the drones that they're flying around. So they're essentially working on signal jammers all the way around the White House and all of these sensitive areas, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, let's use technology to solve the problem as opposed to trying to legislate morality and legislate behavior, because that never really works. And they already do this with the motorcades. They do a whole lot of cell phone jamming and things like that around the big motorcades when they're in the cities to try and prevent signals from getting to bombs, just in case a bomb was there. So it isn't really unusual that they would be doing this. But it is notable to point out that there is a no-fly zone happening in Washington. It's pretty strict right now. So if you do see drones flying around right now, pretty good chance it's nothing to worry about. It's just the Secret Service. But they're going to be doing it from 1 a.m. to 4 a.m. Again, throughout probably the next month or so. So if you're in D.C. and you see one flying around, maybe not total cause for alarm at this point. Here's some other – I think this is great news. I'm going to pigeonhole myself right now, but medical marijuana now has become obviously a pretty powerful leader. I'm a pretty powerful leader. A pretty powerful issue. And right now, some very powerful bipartisan supporters in the U.S. Senate are starting to work towards an actual national medical marijuana bill. And what pot activists say is a historic first, three senators announced that they will introduce a bill that would end the federal ban on medical marijuana. The senators Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Rand Paul from Kentucky will unveil their bill. It's called the Compassionate Access Research Expansion and Respect States Act, and it was introduced yesterday. And if passed, the bill would allow patients, doctors, and businesses in states that have already passed medical marijuana laws to participate in those programs without fear of federal prosecution. Really, what they hope that it will do is change the schedule from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2 so that we could actually do some medical research into it and then probably open up the hemp industry, and it'll probably save our stupid nation. Ladies and gentlemen, just being able to do this and all the ancillary business, we're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars on this. So I'm looking forward to this. And the fact that Rand Paul is behind it, I don't know. I'm kind of leaning back in his direction at this point. What else is going on? Let's see here. Bill O'Reilly in trouble again for lying. We'll probably talk about that quite a bit when Rebecca Roth comes on. It's unusual that all of this stuff is coming out right now, but this Bill O'Reilly story is interesting because it's another story that he has allegedly told that has turned out to be not exactly accurate. And this particular incident has to do with the John F. Kennedy assassination. People were claiming, well, Fox News anchor Bill O'Reilly was reporting that he was basically at the scene when George de Mulrinch Child, who was an associate of Kennedy's, killed himself. And the police records, it points out, show that that was not the case at all. And there was a guy, Edward J. Epstein, who's an investigative researcher for Newsweek, and he published a story basically breaking down the fact that Bill O'Reilly, a lot like most of these people that we see on the network news, they're lying. They're sensationalizing crap. I mean, it's just interesting to me that all this stuff is coming out at the same time. But, you know, if he's lying about that, what in the world else could they be lying about? You know what I mean? Oh, Kev, I totally agree, man. Totally agree. It's all about the chat room. I love having the open forum. Thank God Chris and Cherie put that thing in the vault. I absolutely just love having you guys in the chat room all day. I try and get back and forth between that and just love Truth Frequency, man. Such a great place to be. Okay, we're moving on. Let's get into some economics because holy cow, I'm telling you, I do not know what is going on. And I've been trying to figure this out for a long time now. Dow right now up 50 points. Really unusual stories coming out yesterday, and the headlines were saying, oh, in days of light trading, you know, gold is down a little bit. And I'm looking at the Dow being down almost 300 points and looking at the headline saying, oh, it's a light trading day. And it's like, when did the Dow going down 300 points become a light trading day? That doesn't make any sense to me. But anyway, Dow is up right now, but we're still at 17, 7 and 16, so well below the 18,000 mark. The dollar index, ladies and gentlemen, I went to sleep last night and it was at about 98. I think it was about 98.80, and I was saying to myself, I wonder if when I wake up in the morning it'll have finally broken that 99 mark. And we're up almost another whole percent today. We're at 99.40 right now on the dollar index. And I'll tell you, wow, euro. The euro has broken through 106. We're at 105.91 for the euro. Crazy, because right now, who is it? I think it was Deutsche Bank. A lot of people are kind of changing their predictions here right now. So, yeah, the euro slipping below 107 against the dollar yesterday. That was an 11-year low, as uncertainty in the euro's new bond buying program, a.k.a. euro quantitative easing, combining with the expectations of an imminent interest rate hike by the U.S. Federal Reserve, is pushing investments overseas at this point. The euro lost about 0.13% yesterday. Again, even further down right now, we're sitting – where did I just say we were at with the euro? 105. 92. I mean, that's lower than it was when I just said it a second ago. Just crazy right now. So there are importers in the eurozone. There's a lot of mounting fears that the currency will drop even lower. And on Tuesday, just yesterday, Deutsche Bank, which is, again, the largest bank in Germany, revised its forecast for the euro-dollar parity. Deutsche Bank forecasted the euro and the U.S. dollar would reach parity by the end of this year. This is their prediction from yesterday, okay? Parity by the end of this year. Previously, the bank had predicted it would occur by the end of 2016. And on a long-term basis, Deutsche Bank actually predicts the euro will reach 85 cents by 2017. That's crazy. And their previous forecasts were 95 cents by that point. So we're seeing really a lot of these institutions start saying, okay, this slide is real and it is carrying on right now. We're almost another whole percent down on the euro U.S. dollar today. Bitcoin seems to be the only place that people are putting any kind of money right now. Bitcoin up to 291 and 70 cents. That's about a third of a percent today. Let's look at the commodities. Gold way down, another 10 bucks down today. We're sitting at 1150 for gold. Silver's reaching new lows here, 15, 3, and 43. So $15.34 will get you a big bright shiny ounce of silver. And again, we talked about the Dow already being up about 50 points, which is not a heavy trading day for a Wednesday. Talk about the Baltic Dry right now. My Baltic Dry feed is dead. I don't know why I'm not getting an update here. It's looking like 568. Truth, if you're out there, could you check that for me? I'm looking at 568, which is, as I said, I got a dead feed. I don't know if that's up or down. So anyway, moving there. What else did I want to talk about? Because there was another big economic story that I'm totally forgetting right now, and I can't remember what it was. Okay, well, let's move on here real quick. China's International Payment System, or the CIPS, is due to kick off again this year. It's supposed to be bringing the yuan a step closer to becoming a global trading currency, and this new system will make payment transfers just as easy as in dollars and euro. The launch is expected to be about September or October. Interesting, that September date continually coming up over and over and over again, depending on how tests go, is what they're saying, between September and October. Yes, SWIFT, exactly, Kaiser Chief. So this is essentially exactly like the SWIFT system. It's the CIPS actually will use the same coding system as other international payment systems, a.k.a. SWIFT. And that is supposed to be will make the transactions more fluid and rapid. And the super network will consolidate and replace the existing multiple clearinghouses that process yuan payments right now, and will rival majors like Visa and MasterCard. And that move should help bump the yuan's presence on the international stage as the payment system that will make it faster and easier to carry out cross-border transactions using the Chinese currency. Right now, it is the fifth most used currency in international payments, according to the SWIFT network. In December of 2014, about 2.17% of payments were made in the yuan, which is up from 0.63% in 2013. So that's a significant increase. For a while, China has been exploring methods to cut dependence on the dollar and other hard currencies in international trade, hoping to settle more deals in the yuan. China is the world's second largest economy, and it grew by 7.4% in 2014. Just last week, though, it trimmed its 2015 forecast to only 7%, which is the lowest growth rate target in the last 25 years. But despite the slight slowdown, it is still expected to be the fastest growing economy in 2015, according to a poll of economists by Bloomberg. BDI 565, down by 3. Thank you, Truth. Appreciate that. So there's your BDI index for the day. You realize, Truth, that means you have to be here every day, Monday through Friday from now on, right? I mean, you're kind of pigeonholing yourself as my BDI guy. Love you for it. Okay. Student loans. We want to talk about student loans here real quick. There's going to be a big Obama right now is toying around the idea of a new bankruptcy option for student loans. Why are they doing that? Because right now there's $1.2 trillion of student loans set out. And the punchline really is that over the next decade, it's scheduled to go up by about $3.3 trillion. So they're looking at $3.3 trillion in outstanding debt by 2024, 33% of which will never be paid back, which means about $1 trillion in household debt in the next decade will go bad. Boom. So because student debt is not dischargeable as a personal bankruptcy. Anyway, Barack Obama did say some interesting things yesterday. It does look like we're going to probably end up with a student loan czar, as it discharges tens, if not hundreds of billion dollars of debt, which would never really be repaid anyway. And I highly recommend that you guys go back and look very carefully at any of the contracts that you signed with your lenders, because I would be surprised if they were valid. But that's just me, just saying. Okay, how about seven signs that a stock market peak is happening right meow? This is from Michael Schneider over at Activist Post. He does a really good job at. Number one, just before a stock market crash, price slash earning ratios tend to spike, and that's precisely what we're seeing right now. Number two, the average bull market lasts approximately 3.8 years. The current bull market has already been going on for 6 years. Number three, the median total gain during bull markets usually is about 101.5%. This particular bull market that we are in is up 213%. Usually before a stock market crash, we also see a divergence between the relative strength index and the stock market itself. This happened prior to the bursting of the dot-com bubble, also happened prior to the crash of 2008, and it's happening right now. Okay, number five, in the past, peaks in margin debt have been very closely associated with stock market peaks. Yeah, they still are. And also, We're witnessing a spike in 10-year treasury yields just about the same time that the stock market is peaking. It always happens right before a crash, according to a Business Insider. We just saw the largest five-week rally in two decades. So also number seven, a lot of momentum indicators seem to be telling us that we are rapidly approaching a turning point for stocks. For example, James Stack, who is the editor of Invest Tech Research, says that in the Koprock guide is warning us of an impending bear market, and it's not in the too distant future. So anyway, are we going to have a big stock market correction? Is it important to note that the bear market is up 200% and that usually doesn't happen? I don't know. Plus, at the same time, we're going to see the euro markets really suffer as a result of the quantitative easing there. Although, oh, that was a story I was trying to remember because I didn't pull it up. The head of the Federal Reserve of Dallas yesterday. Now, of course, this isn't the Federal Reserve in New York, but the head of the Federal Reserve in Dallas did come out yesterday with some, well, we know how telling they like to be with their insights, but essentially he's saying very clearly to the market that probably could not wait until June for a rate hike here in the United States. And I think that's why markets are up just a touch today, of course, falling in line with what's going on with the quantitative easing overseas, all of that stuff being connected. Okay, so let's move on from economic stuff. That was all the main stories that I wanted to cover right there. And I've got some good news. I got some good news. If you are a fan, oh, I love you guys. Oh, my gosh. Somebody just found me a sweet MP3 that I wanted. Love you guys. Okay, Dunkin' Donuts. Do you guys like Dunkin' Donuts? I used to eat donuts when I was, you know, seven. But good news. Here's good news coming out of Dunkin' Donuts. Dunkin' Donuts has agreed to remove the titanium dioxide from its powdered sugar donuts. Isn't that nice of them? Oh, I mean, come on. Titanium dioxide, obviously, is used to make the powdered sugar appear brighter. It's also used in things like sunscreen and paint. But the group, as you so, argued that titanium dioxide can actually cause DNA and chromosomal damage when you actually eat it. And the decision by Dunkin' Donuts was recently disclosed by the advocacy group. So the claims that titanium dioxide is actually a nanomaterial, which is not regulated or prohibited by the FDA. But as you so argues, there is not enough information on its effects on humans. So Dunkin' Donuts claims that titanium dioxide does not meet the definition of nanomaterial as outlined under FDA guidance. But nonetheless, it's going to go ahead and take the chemicals out of its donuts. So, man, round of applause to Dunkin' Donuts for that, removing a potentially genetically, you know, altering chemical from its food. Also, I don't know if this is good news or not, but Burger King is kind of interesting. They dropped soft drinks from the kids' meals. So it's getting harder now for kids to get soft drinks at the fast food joint. Burger King dropped the fountain drinks from its kids' menu boards, and they are no longer merchandised as part of the Burger King's kids' meals. The stealth unannounced move late last month by Burger King under pressures from advocacy groups follows similar announcements in recent months by McDonald's and Wendy's. And I didn't know that McDonald's and Wendy's had done that also. I'll tell you, McDonald's sales down right now. I think they're down another 4% this month. They are just absolutely treading water. But anyway, they're trying to obviously appeal to people who are waking up to the fact that most of this fast food that is served to us in this country is garbage. And so now they're trying to do a little bit, I guess. So we kind of got to give them a little bit of props there. And we're not going to give any props to Pepsi right now. Pepsi apparently just won a battle to continue to put the 4-methyllimidazole, or known as 4-MEL, and you can look for that on your Pepsi label. But Pepsi One and Pepsi Diet Pepsi drinkers, speaking to Diet Pepsi drinkers, ladies and gentlemen, lost a battle against the GMO-supporting company PepsiCo recently when a federal judge dismissed a class action lawsuit over the carcinogenic additive 4-MEL, which is found within beverages. The substance 4-MEL is a byproduct of the caramel coloring, and it has been proven to cause cancer in multiple scientific studies. The Coca-Cola company previously eliminated the chemical from its drinks, while PepsiCo did not. So under California's Prop 65, 4-MEL is included on a state list of substances that can cause cancer. An arm of the World Health Organization has also classified 4-MEL as a possible carcinogen. Got links. Paisley, if you go to redpillreport.com and you go to the top of the page there and you look for the show/guest section for the day, all of the news articles are right there for you, brother. That's the easiest place to get them. anyway, Yeah, for MEL, bad, bad news. And so U.S. District Judge Edward Chen dismissed the case against Pepsi, finding no basis for the claim of entitlement due to basically these people were suing Pepsi saying they've ingested this stuff and now they want medical screening. And so this district judge said, well, you guys can't really prove that this 4-MEL causes cancer in humans, and also the threshold levels of exposure to lead to enhanced risk of disease haven't been identified yet, and many other common food products contain similar or higher levels of 4-MEL than Pepsi. So he essentially said, well, everybody else is doing it, so I'm not gonna sue this one company for having this chemical in there. But anyway, the plaintiffs asserted claims against PepsiCo for negligence, strict liability based on defective design, and liability based on failure to warn, seeking medical monitoring as a remedy for all three of those claims. And despite Judge Shen's ignorance, a single can of Pepsi One can contain as much as 43.5 micrograms of 4-MEL, which is not something you want to regularly ingest. Even if PepsiCo won this particular class action lawsuit, you can still hold them accountable as consumers. This is where you start voting with your dollars, ladies and gentlemen. So Pepsi-Cola, Frito-Lay, Gatorade, Tropicana, Quaker, all owned by the PepsiCo, all full of GMO and potentially toxic garbage that they want to put in your body. Again, we talked quite a bit yesterday with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny about the industry of dis-ease, and that is a phrase I think we should coin, an industry of dis-ease, because there are so many facets to trying to keep you sick, and so much money to be made from trying to treat your symptoms when these are the same people who are causing the symptoms in the first place. So anyway, that's what's going on there in your health news. There's a lot of other stuff there. And go to redpillreports.com. Check out some of the extra news, but don't do it right now. Right now, what I want you to do is get your pad of paper and your pen handy, because this guest that we've got coming up is going to be a showstopper, ladies and gentlemen. Please stick with us through this break. 3-minute break. Rebecca Roth is our guest. This is going to be a high water mark, ladies and gentlemen. Keep it right here. Thanks for being here. So we'll be right back.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR. Did you know that the blue lotus flower was used by the ancient Egyptians as an aphrodisiac to experience feelings of euphoria and ecstasy? And ecstasy. And ecstasy. Did you know that Thai kratom was used by the Buddhist monks to produce a relaxing and dreamlike state? Did you know San Pedro cactus was used by the Native Americans to quest for visions and heal the body? Bouncing Bear Botanicals is your number one supplier of rare and sacred plants and a proud sponsor of Truth Frequency Radio. By clicking on the banner at truthfrequencyradio.com, you can learn more about a vast selection of entheogens, including Amanita muscaria, also known as the sacred mushroom. So click on the banner at truthfrequencyradio.com, and you'll also get up to $40 off your next order.
Archaeology, astronomy, alchemy, secrets of the Holy Bible, hidden codes of the Quran, demonology, Tesla technology, solar power, extraterrestrials in the ancient world. More than 500 documentaries, an experimental film lab of cutting-edge music and art, full-length movies, conference reports, and weekly TV shows. The Enigma Channel is the world's first truly global TV station. www.enigmatv.com. Intelligent television for planet Earth.
No hate, no hype, no fear.
You're listening to Truth Frequency Radio.
We are TFR.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very, very much for sticking with us through that three-minute break, and thank you guys for joining us for the program today. We're moving into the second hour of the broadcast right now, and today, again, being the 11th day of March, I'm beyond excited to be bringing you the guests that we've got lined up here right now. Ladies and gentlemen, we're bringing a new author to the stage. Her name is Rebecca Roth, and she has written a book called Methodical Illusion. You can go to methodicalillusion.com. If you go to redpillreports.com, of course, we'll have the link there for you in the show section, and you can also find out a little bit more about Rebecca Roth. But for you guys who don't know her, which I assume will be just about everyone out there, she enjoyed a nearly 30-year airline career. She worked both as a flight attendant and as an international purser. She was trained as an emergency medical technician, and she also served as a volunteer firefighter. Her expertise and training as a flight attendant allowed her to research the events of 9/11 with an insider's knowledge that eventually led her to discover details and answers to some of the most haunting questions that still surround that most infamous day in our history. Literally, after thousands of hours of research using official government documents, print, and video media from 9/11, and several books, she discovered that there were at least two women involved in the 9/11 event. And using her personal knowledge of in-flight procedures, FAA hijacking protocols, the state of Massachusetts, and cell phone technology, she also discovered yet-to-be-exposed details concerning the planes, the passengers, and the perpetrators, which were woven into this book, Methodical Illusion. It was written as a novel, and it is absolutely outstanding, ladies and gentlemen. And I know you guys know that I read a lot of books here for the program. I blew through this one in like 6 hours because I could not put it down. And it was funny because I was in constant communication with Rebecca pretty much the entire second half of the book, because it was just like, I kept reading. I'd turn a page and I would get full body tingles, because some of the information that is laid out in this book is not only new to me, which is rare, but it was the way that it was laid out, the way it was weaved into this very casual conversation, that you're picking up all of this stuff that you would normally not pick up. So, ladies and gentlemen, please, first and foremost, get a piece of paper and a pencil ready, because Rebecca is going to be going over stuff that you probably have not heard before. I want you guys to go ahead and buckle your seatbelts, put your tray tables up in the full locked position. And what are we supposed to do if the oxygen masks fall down? We're supposed to help us first and then the people next to us. Seriously, though, Rebecca Roth, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us on the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's, the pleasure is all mine, and believe me, listeners, I'm not saying that lightly. Rebecca, could you please talk to us a little bit about what inspired you to write this book?
Well, you know, I was always that one flight attendant that everything always happened to. You know, movie stars were on board, or sports stars were on board. I was usually having dinner with them, or, you know, trekking in the jungles with them, whatever. I mean, it was always like, that was always the case. And everyone I flew with always said, you need to write a novel. You need to write a book, you know.
Right.
And so a long time after my retirement, I quit flying in 2004. And it's interesting what happened to me, because I really wasn't interested in the entire 9/11 event for for many reasons. One, while you're in the business and you, after 9/11, we realized that NORAD isn't going to scramble for us. And that was such a reality check, that you just had to go into, refusal to look, or what we refer to commonly now as cognitive dissonance. And we have, our society seems to be split into those that are awake or awakening or starting to feel like something's wrong, feeling that water around us getting a little bit warm and ready to jump out of the pot.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, it just seems to be, it's interesting what happened. So what I did was I started to write a novel, and I thought, oh, I'm going to bring in a Middle Eastern gentleman, just a different culture and someone from somewhere back there in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And I Google searched the 19 Arab hijackers from 9/11, and lo and behold, a BBC article shows up, and there's like six of them alive, and the Saudi government is suing the FBI.
Yeah, they're ticked.
And the article was dated September 23rd, 2001. And I thought, well, how did I miss this? Cause I paid close attention to the entire event when it was unfolding. Luckily I was home watching it all on television, and I didn't fly again because I was an international purser, and we just couldn't get all our planes and all our crew members and everything together. And by the way, my schedule had been originally designed. I didn't fly anything for 10 days. So I watched all of it for 10 days. Mm-hmm. One, I had never been, as a crew member, ever told about a hijacker named or a terrorist named Osama bin Laden or a group named Al-Qaeda. So I was blown away that they could control NORAD. I was like, well, who is this guy? Must be the smartest man in the world. Mm-hmm. I was like, what? Because every year when we do our yearly recurrent training, which I talk about quite a bit in the book, even though we hate it, it's very boring. You go over the same thing all the time. We had very set protocols that were not followed that day by the crew members. And that, as I started researching this, once I found those hijackers were still alive, I put the novel aside and I went into in-depth 9/11 research. I mean, I was crazed. Like I always tell people, like the guy on Close Encounters that built the Devil's Tower in his house.
Mashed potatoes, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was there. I could not believe what I was discovering and uncovering, and the Brady bonds and the gold heist and the insurance fraud, the put options, and people that came forward. And you know, I was very lucky. I mean, there's a character in my book named Gary Gill. He's a special operations weatherman.
Mm-hmm.
He's real. That's just not his real name.
Right.
I didn't meet him on an airplane, but I met him somewhere else and had very much that conversation with him. And, you know, he was there in Afghanistan a few days later. He was with a unit that had Osama bin Laden in a, you know, dead on the right shot. And the United States government, and this is weeks after 9/11, refused to allow them to shoot.
Yep.
And, so that whole incident is a real incident. And there's a lot of reality dealt, woven in here, as mm-hmm. you saw.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did was I put my novel aside and I got into this research, and then I thought, well, how in the world am I going to write this without being a drone strike? Because what I discovered, no one else had found. And, for instance, you know, I found, it looked to me like the FBI was covering things up as mm-hmm. fast as they were creating the reality shortly after the event opened up for us. The FBI came out within hours, I believe it was 12, and it kind of all runs together now when I look back. It just is surprisingly fast that they found these 19 Arab hijackers.
Right.
Well, there was four people on their original list that most people probably don't even know exist, but this is in a book by Paul Zaremka, and they go in pretty much in depth in this. The original four people, when there were two sets of brothers, and one of them was, three of the four were alive and showed up and said, hey, we were not on the manifest because we're here. We didn't go through the building. We're not dead. We're not terrorists. And one of them was a federal employee with the FAA and aviation security based in Florida. Cool. And his brother, who the FBI was claiming's name was on the list, on the passenger manifest, was dead for a year. So he said, I wasn't there, and I can guarantee you my brother wasn't. He's been dead for a year.
Right.
And so quickly, very, very quickly, the FBI took their stories and I believe it was the Bukhari brothers, which one was dead and one was the FAA employee, that they had assigned Mohammed Atta's rental car story to. And so they just quickly changed it and put Mohammed Atta there. Mohammed Atta's father, by the way, claimed he talked to his son on September 12, 2001, and he also told a journalist with, I believe it was the Telegraph from the UK, that his son was an employee for the Israeli Mossad, and if they were questioning his safety and whereabouts, they should talk to the Mossad. So I thought that was kind of interesting. As I mean, I just went in there and I just thought, well, how did anybody live? That's just impossible. Well, then I started to discover women involved and the cover-up by the FBI. They never let all of this information out. And some of the stuff that you read that really made your hair on the back of your neck stand up is actually from FBI documents that I discovered online. I'm no special agent, although some people tried to say I'm a CIA agent.
Right.
No, I had a 30-year airline career prior to 9/11. So if you do your math, you're knowing that I'm in retirement. I am not a 30-year-old CIA agent. And so that just makes me laugh when I hear that. It's like, what? It's like, come on, there's all kinds of unemployed 30-year-olds that would love to be CIA agents. Why would they pick a grandmother? Anyway, that's kind of what happened to me, and I started doing that, and I thought, well, I'm just going to take that original novel. So when you start into those first two or three pages where I found Khalid Al-Hazmi, mm-hmm. and he actually has the names of two of the hijackers, I did exactly what the other nine hijackers, I found 10 of them are most likely alive,
yes.
or stolen identities,
right.
and the other nine people that are much deeper into the intelligence world than I'll ever go are basically claiming that the FBI, our Federal Bureau of Investigation that made claims of who these characters were, actually did what I was going to do for my novel. They went in and just pulled a first name from one character and a last name from another, and they're completely cooked up individuals.
Right.
There were not 19 Arab hijackers listed on the real passenger manifest at all.
Wait, are you saying then that the passport that magically fluttered down to the street after the building came down, that wasn't real? I'm confused.
Well, it was a real passport.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't really in that guy's shirt pocket that went through the building and through the plane and through the fireball and all of that.
That seemed unplausible. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I found later on, after the 9/11 truth veil is lifted, and mine certainly was, you'll see that that's kind of a symptom of a false flag everywhere. And you'll remember the thing in Paris that just happened, the Charlie Hebdo. Mm-hmm. And of course who wouldn't go on a terrorist attack like that without bringing their ID and then leave it in a stolen car?
Exactly.
I mean, and I didn't know this, but since the book came out, someone called and, you know, I do autographed books and I have myself pretty well available to people on my Facebook account. And you can go on the website and find the link because there's lots of Rebecca Ross out in the world. And you can find a link right to my Facebook and become friends with me on Facebook. So you can ask questions of what's real, what's not. And if you want to see some of the documents I used, that's cool. I can send you a link or tell you where I found those. And I'm happy to do that with the reader. And so anyway, I just lost my train of thought. This is my morning here.
Well, I think people really want to just know where your research has taken you, because again, you have this unique perspective as somebody who's not only EMT qualified, but you were a volunteer firefighter plus a flight attendant and an international purser for 30 years. There's really not anybody else out there who understands FAA policy and what should have happened on that day and where all these, your red flags are going to be a lot different than everybody else's red flags because we don't have experience with yours. But I want to talk about where your research has taken you and where we're at today.
Well, yeah. What I did was as I start to gather all this information, I've discovered that the flight attendants were making really strange phone calls with really weird details and didn't follow the protocols. Just so you know, at the time of 9/11, the FAA had a solidly set protocol. We reviewed it every year in our yearly training. And basically it was called the Common Strategy, and it was, your first thing you would do if you were not the one a flight attendant that the hijacker had by the neck or had a gun to their throat or whatever, you were to sit down and not draw attention to yourself. That means you're not running up and down the aisles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You were to sit down. You know, that means cover up your wings and name tag with a coat, a blanket, act like you're a passenger asleep, and do not do a thing to draw attention to yourself. So, well, that wasn't being followed. And as I listened to the official story I was hearing on flight 11, two flight attendants call in and give the craziest information, like their work position. And then I started to really look really closely at what they said and the time they said it and what the National Transportation Safety Board was claiming was going on in the aircraft, et cetera. And I discovered some things that were really mind-blowing, and I wrapped them all. I tried to wrap as many of them into the book. I know interviews I'm able to talk a little bit more in depth. But that first flight, Flight 11, mm-hmm. Betty Ong, actually, one of the first things she said was he, as in one hijacker, he has sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. She claims she was at 3R jump seat, which is 150-some feet away from business class.
Okay.
And so, and she was on the phone for 27 minutes. She never coughed. She never complained about the pepper spray or mace.
Right.
And there was another flight attendant sitting in the second to the last row of coach seats, not too far from her. They were giving completely conflicting information. That flight attendant called into her supervisor and claimed that the hijacker, again, one single male, mm-hmm. was seated in 9B.
Ooh.
And so then she called back and she said, oh, I made a mistake. The hijacker's in 10B, but 9B was stabbed with a, you know, obviously they had box cutters. She didn't say that, but that's what we were led to believe later by Barbara Olson.
And he was the only person killed on that plane, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. Okay. Uh-huh. And so then I saw that Betty Ong, the other one, said, we're the first. And then I thought, well, somebody must have told her the scenario. So they were the first plane. Remember, Flight 11 was the one that
How would they know that on the plane?
Someone had to have told her they were the first. Right. And so I got to seeing things like, okay, they had a handler on board that said, okay, and I think the best thing, now I have lots of American flight attendants and pilots that have come forward. Mm-hmm. And the best thing that we could figure out is that not Arab hijackers, but the high handlers on board, probably 9B might have been one. I'll talk about him in a second. They were probably told, because there were so many military war games going on that day, and the pilots, quite possibly when they were in operations, filing their flight plan, may have even been given a heads up. I'm hoping that some of them come forward that were leaving from that northeast sector that morning to tell me that they, in fact, were told by their company operations that, A, if you see something, hear something strange, there's war games going on. Mm-hmm. Because they made things appear and disappear on different radar systems that day. And we'll talk about those two companies that did that.
Okay.
And so I think what they were told was, you're part of a drill and this is the scenario of the day. There'll be four hijackings, blah, 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 mm-hmm. and gave them the details. That's how she knew they were the first. And then she also said another thing that really got me going, because between the pepper spray and mace and her saying he stood upstairs. There are no stairs in the 767. The only aircraft that has stairs on board is a 747. Okay. And I knew that. And so I thought, okay, we've got her saying we're the first. Mm-hmm. He stood upstairs and they have this pepper spray or mace. If you sprayed pepper spray or mace in a pressurized cabin, it would be taking over the hijackers themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The pilots, because it's not an airtight door in the cockpit, so you can see the daylight through there, and the crew members and the passengers. Everyone would have been affected. And since I never heard either one of these flight attendants complain about the effects of the gas, it told me the aircraft was no longer pressurized.
What should they have said if they were going to make, I mean, first of all, would they have made a private cell phone call to a supervisor? I mean, is that anywhere in the realm of normal for protocol? And what, you know, what should have happened in terms of an actual flight attendant on the plane in the event of a real hijacking?
In the event of a real hijacking, of course, do not draw attention to yourself would mean not sit on a telephone for 27 minutes.
I would think so, right?
If a hijacker walked through the aisle and saw that you were sitting on the phone giving information, he would know that his plan was about to be skiboshed. And so if you were to do that, maybe if you were in a position where you were in the bathroom, in the lavatory, or somewhere where you wouldn't be seen on the phone, you certainly wouldn't be sitting in a passenger seat or in your jump seat talking on the phone for a half an hour.
Right.
So that's kind of odd. What they should have said at this point, if we were to believe the official story, the most important detail they could have given was how the hijackers got into the cockpit. How? Did they kick the door in? Did they use some explosive device? Did they have a key? How? How they got in there? That was the only important real detail. And that then I started looking at the details that they said, and it really, as I started to see this unfold, and I saw that within 18 minutes of a transcontinental flight, you have the flight attendant working the back galley saying she can't call the cockpit. They won't answer their phone. There's no reason that a flight attendant working coach would need to call the cockpit that early on in a flight. We don't reach a cruising altitude till almost then. And the first thing she would be doing would be preparing the breakfast carts and getting everything loaded up, the juice and the coffee and all that stuff, because we always go right into breakfast and try to serve people as soon as possible on those early morning flights because they've been up since 4 or 5 in the morning getting to the airport.
Well, and in the ascent, aren't you guys strapped into your seats? I mean, you guys aren't up walking around either, right?
That's correct. Okay. And it made me realize that the only reason she would call the cockpit was if they started a descent. And she wouldn't want to pull those carts out because those things weigh about 450 pounds.
Right.
And you don't want them loose for a landing. And if you're starting to descent, which I'm sure she felt on her feet, the airplane didn't reach cruise altitude. And that's when we pulled those carts out. Then she would have wanted to call the cockpit. And then also, according to the real story, there's flight attendants walking up and down the aisles giving her information. That absolutely would not be happening.
Okay. Wow.
And so what I saw was that she was somewhere with a stairs, like inside a hangar. Mm-hmm. They were no longer pressurized, and they were 18 minutes from Boston, Massachusetts.
And just for the obvious aside, do cell phones when you were working, you know, were cell phones able to be used at cruising altitude in 2001?
Absolutely not. Okay. As a matter of fact, I flew a couple years ago, and I monitored my cell phone reception. And after about 1,800 feet to 2,000 feet, you lose all cell reception unless you are now. There are some aircraft now that are, you know, working much like a Skype technology using satellite. But no, in 2001, the aircraft itself acted like a Faraday cage. So you could be on the ground in, you know, Minneapolis, Detroit, Chicago, some major airport in the middle of the country and have no cell reception just because of the aluminum wrapping around the aircraft and the wiring.
Okay.
So no,
the likelihood that those calls were made from the air, probably not the case.
That's very correct. That was the one red flag that really got me that first morning was, how were they using cell phones?
Mm-hmm.
Impossible that you, there's just couldn't do it. So that told me that the calls had to have been made on the ground, that there was stairs, the aircraft were not pressurized. And using the time frame from that very first flight, they had to be within 18 minutes of Boston. So I took the next flight, which also left for Boston. I did the same thing. Now the next flight, interesting, I had passengers on flight 175, also left from Boston, supposedly hit the South Tower. A passenger on that plane said something that really got me going. He called his father at 8:52 a.m. and he told his father the airline hostess had been stabbed.
The airline hostess.
Yes. And that is a terminology that Americans do not use. It's used in the Middle East. El Al, for instance, you can Google search El Al, the Israeli airline, and airline hostess, and you'll see lots of pictures and Google images of that. It's a term that maybe is used in foreign countries and Asia. And so I thought, oh, somebody has to have been either telling him that or he's reading a cue card or someone told him that terminology because that's just something an American wouldn't say. He was only 32. So since 1968, we had been called flight attendants because that's when men came into that. Prior to that, in the United States, we were referred to as stewardesses. So,
oh, okay.
There's just no way he would use that terminology. And then again, he called his father back at 9 o'clock. Keeping in mind, this is now 3 minutes prior to impact. Mm-hmm. And, just watching a movie.
It would have been chaos. It would have been chaos on that plane.
Well, hey, not only that, I just watched a movie that, started last night. I'm trying to remember it was Bourne Supremacy I watched. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they actually did a fly-in into Manhattan at the beginning of this movie.
Right.
Or I think it was the beginning of the movie. And I remember saying to my husband, okay, here's what they would have been seeing 3 minutes before the aircraft hit. And so here's some interesting things. He says 3 minutes before impact. Now, this is Manhattan. Now, keep in mind, New York is like 350 some or 360 square miles. Mm-hmm. You know you're in New York, Newark, that whole entire area. If you've ever flown in there just even one time or even maybe seen it in a movie.
Right.
3 minutes before impact, 9 a.m. that morning, he tells his father on a second call that he thinks the terrorists are going to fly the aircraft to Chicago and fly it into a building. Well, he had to have been told that scenario because we were now less than 15 minutes after something hit the North Tower and you and I didn't even know what hit it.
Right.
So there's no way a passenger who had no way of knowing what was going on down below unless someone told him. Then at 9 o'clock, there was another guy that called out, Brian Sweeney. He was an F-14 pilot. He was a Top Gun pilot. He was 6'2", 225 pound. He called his mother and she said, well, where are you? And he said, well, we're over Ohio. Well, if you're a pilot and you've been around and he's maybe 30 some years old, 38 maybe, and you look out the window and you're over Manhattan 3 minutes before impact and you think you're over Ohio, there's something wrong.
Right.
And so I thought, well, okay, this is weird. And then he also says this to his mother, and this is in an FBI transcript I found, that he thinks that a group of passengers are going to take over the cockpit. That is the scenario from Flight 93. So that told me that scenario that later played out in Flight 93 was already written in a script.
Right. Wow.
There's no way he would know that.
Right.
And another thing I found out interesting about him, even though his friends all from Miramar and Top Gun Flight School said about him that he could kill any human being with his bare hands, he chose to sit on the phone and talk to his mom and do nothing.
Right.
But also the whole idea of being in Ohio, just so people understand this, if you go from Boston to Cleveland, which is kind of on the eastern border of Ohio, it's an hour and 45-minute flight.
Oh, so there's no way he would have misestimated the time that he'd been in the air.
Because they had been in the air 44 minutes.
Right.
And so when I see these things, I'm like, what? It's just crazy.
Well, and there's so much more crazy. We have, unfortunately, Rebecca, we've got to go to a 3-minute break here real quick. It's our only one. When we come back, I want to talk more about your research into these phone calls, what the FBI's response to these phone calls was, and where you think potentially these phone calls were made. I also really want to talk about the gentleman who was in 9B. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you are enjoying this broadcast. Do stick with us here. Rebecca Roth is our guest, methodicalillusion.com, and Methodical Illusion is the book. Cannot recommend it highly enough, ladies and gentlemen. Keep it right here. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN. Worldwide.
Sure, I'm glad I tried that new Iodine Now microplant powder formulation.
You liked it, huh? I told you it would change your life.
Yeah, I feel fantastic, and I have so much more energy.
Hi, I have your Iodine Now delivery.
Oh, yes, my second order arrived. Thank you so much.
Hey, buddy, why don't you ask this lady out for a date?
Good idea. Now that I'm taking iodine now, I have the energy to enjoy my life again.
It looks like you're getting back your old charm, buddy.
I'd love to go out to dinner with you. And can I try some of the iodine now?
Of course you can. You just delivered me a one-year supply.
Your future looks really great.
I finally agree with you.
Iodine Now, part of the MicroPlant Powder family. MicroPlant Powder is available in 15 different formulations. Call 888-910-4367 or visit the website to find the one that's right for you. And listen to our new audio descriptions for every product only at MintUSA.org.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed-saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American-owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Down the rabbit hole with Popeye, Tuesday through Friday,
Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys so much for sticking with us through that 3-minute break and for being in the chat room today. It is so nice to have you guys all along for the ride. I hope you are enjoying the broadcast today with the one and only Rebecca Roth. She is the author of Methodical Illusion. You can check it out at methodicalillusion.com. Absolutely amazing, amazing book, ladies and gentlemen. And the reason I think that she wrote it as a novel is so she can sneak covertly all of this incredible information into the minds of people who may not be ready to go dig out a big book on 9/11. And I think that you could give this book to your brother, your sister, your mother, somebody like that that maybe needs a little bit more coaxing, because we haven't reached saturation point with 9/11. I met a guy the other day who had just come around to the idea that 9/11 could potentially have been more than the mainstream media would have us believe. So I hope you guys are enjoying the program so far. Rebecca, I want to get back into some of the research that you have been doing. We were talking about the phone calls that were made from some of the flight attendants. I did have CeCe Lyle's stuff here up ready to go, but I'm having trouble getting it to go right now. So okay. If you want to get back into some of the anomalies that happened with the flight attendants' phone calls and then maybe talk about the timeline as you discovered and then maybe do some conjecture on where you think those phone calls could have possibly come from. That would be, we are all ears.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, if you get that keyed up and ready to go, just let me know.
Will do.
The thing that is interesting is FBI showed up at the people who received these phone calls, really quickly, and they tried to deny that they were cell phone calls to begin with. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a guy on a passenger on Flight 93, Tom Burnett. He called his wife in California, and this is, keep in mind now, around 6 in the morning or so, and she was a retired flight attendant. So she looks at her caller ID when the phone rang, and it said Tom's cell. So she immediately thinks there's something wrong. He never got on his plane. This is like, are you okay? What's going on?
Right.
And then he tells her he's hijacked and he's in the air. And a lot of the callers used this term, we're in the air. Even one guy asked his mother after using his first and last name, Mark Bingham, Hi, mother. This is Mark Bingham. Nobody does that to their mother. They don't need to. We know your voice. And so He said, "You do believe me, don't you, Mom?" And so it was as if they were being told to say they're in the air, to paint that scenario that they were actually in the air. And that happened a lot in a lot of the calls.
Right.
So when the FBI shows up at her doorstep in about a half an hour after she contacted them, they tried to tell her that it was impossible for him. He couldn't have called from a cell phone, but he did actually call from a cell phone because, again, what I did was I took that location and I took all of the flights and I took the time that the phone calls were made, knowing that they all had to have been made on the ground.
Right.
They also reported from Flight 175 that pepper spray or mace had been used. And so that again told me that at 3 minutes before impact, that guy wasn't coughing or having a hard time breathing either. So that plane wasn't pressurized either. And so I charted all this out and I spent about a month debunking this because truly it made me physically sick when I discovered how the planes were taken over. And a lot of people don't understand this, but in the 90s, there was a company called the SPC, Sam Paul Charlie, SPC Corporation, that cooked up a device, and it's actually what we as the American government, use to fly our drones around the world. It's called the Flight Termination System, FTS, referred to. The Flight Termination System was a plug-in device that you could plug into an onboard computer, and it was sold to the airlines. And listen to this carefully. Quote, "In the event of a hijacking, and a hijacker took control of the cockpit, I never figured out who that was until 9/11, we can remotely control the aircraft and land it at the nearest location where a SWAT team or FBI or Navy SEALs can liberate the plane and the passengers." Mm-hmm. Now, I bet everyone listening wonders, and everyone in the chat room, why didn't they do that on 9/11? We had four aircraft that were led to believe the cockpits were commandeered, taken over, and they had the flight termination system. American referred to theirs as the flight interruption system on board the aircraft. Well, it was already being used, and once that turns on, it runs on a frequency that's the same frequency that operates the transponder on board. And the transponder code, like on flight 11, the transponder code was 1143. It's like a radio frequency. When the flight termination system took over, and this is why the pilots hated the whole idea, they lost all communication. And remember Betty Ong said, "We can't communicate to the pilots. Right. They're not answering their phone." Again, that told me, uh-oh, they were taken over remotely by the flight termination system because no air traffic controllers, the flight attendants, nobody could talk to these planes, all four of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, you now you're probably thinking, okay, they lost their transponder, so air traffic controllers can't see them. At the time of 9/11, there were two companies called, one was called PTEC, a software company, and one was called MITRE. They were in the headquarters of the FAA, and their job that day was to make things appear and disappear on radar for the military war games going on board. Mm. That day we had almost a dozen different military war exercises going on, and one of them was to make the fighter pilots that were participants be able to see something that actually wasn't there. And so they were able to erase things that were really there, like these four aircraft that the flight termination system took over.
Mm-hmm.
And they show us where they want us to believe they went, which was out toward Cleveland. And so a lot of people went out toward Cleveland, and some people are out there thinking that all four plane loads of passengers were put on one aircraft because they could, one 767 could almost hold that many, barely. And they were taken to a NASA hangar and killed in Cleveland, but the phone calls don't work. I went there, I tried to make it work. They had to have taken all of these planes to some place, and so what I started looking for was an area where they had a super long runway, and it had to be over 10,000 feet, because these aircraft were coming loaded, it's called a heavy jet, and they were loaded full of fuel.
Flight, right.
They needed a long runway, and they needed nobody in the towers. Now, the area that I did find, it's in the book. I usually don't talk about exact location because I want people to read the book for many other reasons, as you saw when you read it.
Because
mm-hmm. there's lots of details woven in there, and probably the second time you read it, you'll think, oh, yes, I remember that happened on 9/11. I may have worked it into a fictitious event, but you'll see the, for instance, the passenger information and private information on passengers won't come through that quickly as you saw on 9/11.
Right.
And, there's an accident there where a hotel casino is turned to dust. And there are things that are just so 9/11. If you know anything about 9/11. And if you don't, I wrote this book from the standpoint I was at. I was in cognitive dissonance, and as I woke up, slowly but surely every piece of information I gobbled up, and so what I wanted to do was write a book so that you could give this to your mom or your sister and let her get into that story and into that character, and then when that character starts uncovering the 9/11 truth, so will your mom or your sister.
Yes.
And that is happening, and I get Facebook comments from people, you woke my mother up, I no more fights at Thanksgiving. And so people are really thrilled about it. And I think that's kind of cool because that really was my mission. And so, you know, as I went in there and tried to find this, I wanted to just quickly touch before I lose this thought.
Okay.
On flight 11, the passenger that the flight attendant first claimed was a hijacker in 9B. First off, let me just say this. We train for this. This is one of the things we train for. Every emergency situation on board, whether it's a fire, a heart attack, defibrillating you because there's defibrillators on board nowadays.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If it's a wheels up landing, our landing gear falls. If it's, water landing like you saw in the Hudson, we train for those things every year in our yearly recurrent training. And hijacking is one of the cells in our training every year. And so we have these protocols to follow. One thing that a flight attendant would never do is, one, give over any emergency situation to untrained passengers, because we're all trained to do it, and we're all trained to do the same thing.
Right, okay.
And two, we would never, ever, ever in a million years claim that you, as a passenger, might be a terrorist or a hijacker if you weren't 150% sure. Because like I said, the name of the game and the goal is to land that aircraft and liberate the passengers and crew in the aircraft by some SWAT force of some sort.
Number one priority, safety
exactly.
of the people. Okay.
Safety of the passengers. Mm-hmm. That's what we eat, drink, and sleep that. And so on that flight where you remember Amy Sweeney, the flight attendant from Flight 11, claimed that 9B was the hijacker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went back and I looked into this guy because he's quite a hero online. And if you look him up, and you can just Google search 9B Flight 11, you'll get lots of information on him.
Yep.
Well, it's interesting. He grew up in Denver, Colorado. He moved to Israel when he was 14 with his family. He joined the Israeli Defense Forces. It's mandatory when you turn 18 and get out of school. And then he joined the Mossad's Special Operations Unit called the Sayeret Matkal. What the Sayeret Matkal is that they are highly trained assassins. What are the chances we have a hijacking on board and Israeli Defense Forces, the Mossad, the Mossad has a highly trained assassin sitting right there in the row in front of the hijackers? He was also trained as an anti-hijacking specialist and a hostage rescue specialist.
Can you say handler?
Yes, I can, because I did.
Yeah.
I saw that. I thought, well, that I can't even stretch my mind enough to believe that this guy who was fluent in English, Hebrew, and Arabic, for no reason at all, we're supposed to believe that the guys behind him that are sitting talking in Arabic right behind his ear. And
right.
If he's
she corrected herself, said that no, it was 10B. So it was the people right behind. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so you're expected to believe this guy who could understand every word the Arabic speaking hijackers were making not 2 feet away from his ears. And you know, if you've ever been on an airplane and you're listening to the people in the row behind you, they're talking over the jet sound.
Yep.
So they're talking loud and it's going right in the direction because they're facing forward because that's where their seats are, and they're facing right to your ear. So you hear those people, and if you just recall back how much you can hear of conversation, you've maybe been a part of a conversation you didn't want to be a part of, or an argument.
Right.
Or
well, it's got to be pointed out also, not only was this guy the guy that got killed by the box cutter, the only guy, the research that I did after reading your book and going and looking into this guy, what's his name, Daniel Lewin, I think is his name. They said that he could kill any person on the planet using just a pin and a credit card.
That's
we're talking about a guy who suddenly was unaware of his surroundings and was killed by a box cutter. Really? One of the most highly trained, assassins on the planet, really?
Well, it's interesting, and a great Google search for your listeners too is look up Sayeret Matkal, and I'll give you a spelling of it. It's Sayeret Matkal. And if you read about this, it's interesting to note, we just had a highly trained assassin speak to the U.S. Congress, Bibi Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm. In the same group, I was wondering if you were going to mention that Netanyahu is also part of that Sariet. Yeah. Mm.
And another interesting character pops up in the 9/11 investigation that I found. Ehud Barak, who was the prime minister at the time of 9/11, I believe he was either just getting out of office or still in office. I think he just got out of office and Bibi Netanyahu had just gotten in. But Ehud Barak was in New York City September 10th, 2001. On the morning of September 11th, if you'll recall and look back, and you can find YouTubes on him, he was in the BBC studios. He's the man who coined the phrase war on terror, and he is one of the very first people that told us from London that it was Osama bin Laden behind this attack.
Wow.
And he also is a Sayeret Metcal and a trained assassin. That's what they do. I mean, that's what they are. And it's interesting what they, Sayeret Metcal does do outside of Israel. So I found some interesting stuff, and there's also some interesting information. And you know, I told you on the phone that a lot of what happened to me has been a sort of divinely inspired. Mm-hmm. I wrote this book 2 years ago and it sat. I didn't know what to do with it. I honestly thought that nobody would want to read it, and anybody that did would get mad at me for what I discovered. And as I tried to debunk my own finding for over a month, because I couldn't believe what I was finding, that this really was handlers, not the 19 Arabs. And the reason I got sick, not only just for the passengers and crew that were involved and innocently murdered that day, and the people in the towers that jumped out, and the people that, the firefighters, all of those things. I mean, I died all the deaths with them. But I also, I couldn't believe that we have been manipulated by a group of people that control our media.
Mm-hmm.
And that millions, and that is millions of Middle Eastern Muslim people have died innocently over a charade. And this was an illusion. It was methodically thought out. It was completely under control. And what I think that I have discovered right now, I have a terabyte of FAA and NORAD Freedom of Information data.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks to me that we are about to be able to indicate in their own documentation that this was not extremely well planned, and some information even preloaded into computers.
Right. Well, let's talk about that for just a second, the how did they do it aspect, because you mentioned PTEC and you mentioned MITRE. We haven't yet, and I'm wondering if our Skype connection will immediately go fuzzy, but we haven't talked about the PROMISE program yet. Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of the weaving of the infrastructure for a second?
Yeah, it's really interesting. That PTEC company, just so you know, that's it's PTECH, yep. And they've changed their name. They were in control of 22 U.S. government computer systems at the time of 9/11. They'd been in the headquarters of the FAA in Washington for 2 years leading up to 9/11. They were a five-year-old company at the time. So how they got into this, first off, PTEC is foreign-owned. They're owned by a Lebanese gentleman, financed. And they were financed by another multimillionaire from Saudi Arabia. And interestingly enough, their marketing man was a Jewish attorney from, I think he's from Boston area. Their headquarters was in Quincy, which is just off the south runway. So if you take off from Boston, go off to the north, which is these aircraft did, and they circle around. They literally flew right over PTEC's headquarters, and they probably weren't much more than 10,000 feet elevation at that time, which could be exactly when the flight termination system zeroed in on their frequencies and were able to quickly grab onto those. Now, they may or may not have done that at that point, but they sure as heck could have. Coincidentally, they just go over their deal. Also, and so you know that at Dulles, at Newark, and at Boston, the security company that ran security for the magnetometers at the time, you would go through the metal detectors, were also Israeli-owned company. Just coincidentally, Huntley.
Coincidentally.
I think their initials, ICTS, was the name of the company. So, yeah, it's very interesting to see all these connections. So this, here's what happened with the PTEC software company that was involved in all of these U.S. government. They actually even handled the Air Force One and the White House bunker. They were not able to speak to each other. First time ever in history, only time ever in history, until noon that day.
Wow.
But they actually have their software in, not just the U.S. Navy, NORAD, the FAA, all the military, major banks, lots of embassies. This Promise software came out. It was by the InSlaw company. Bill Hamilton was the CEO. Mm-hmm. Sold it to the Department of Justice, United States government, in the 80s. In the mid-80s, that software, Promise, P-R-O-M-I-S, no E at the end, all capital letters. You can do a Wikipedia search on this and learn about it quickly. It was stolen by the head of the Israeli Mossad. Can you believe that? Another coincidence bringing the Israeli Mossad in. And so what they did is they hired a guy named Michael Rizkan-Shuto, this kind of an IT guy, who installed a backdoor into that software. That software found its way, I'm sure, into the PTEC company, into the software that they installed into all of these embassies and all of these U.S. agencies. And what that it was able to do, it's a backdoor, so they can go in and put anything in your computer or on your screen they want.
Right.
And they can make things appear and disappear. If you're a radar screen at a Boston control center, they could make something appear or disappear from radar. Also, the company, the MITRE company, M-I-T-R-E, that is the shadow government. And one of their main specialties is radar. And I have this terabyte of radar in text data form.
Right.
That's what I'm looking at. So they were able to take that text radar, and they could actually even have made the fake flight plan of the supposed aircraft after they were landed,
mm-hmm.
and make them fly into the building or into the Pentagon or into Shanksville and preload that information.
Wow.
Into the FAA computer systems. That's, you know, that kind of stuff they could do. This was their specialty. And interesting enough, the gentleman that was the F-14 pilot, mm-hmm. that thought he was in Ohio. Well, after I finished and got my book out and it was online, I kept researching. I'm still researching to this day. I was up till about 3 a.m. going through this FAA data, because what I just said to you is kind of what I'm finding.
Right.
Okay. And, what I found is that gentleman is was an employee of the MITRE company.
No way.
The guy who thought he was not in Manhattan, but over Ohio.
Right.
He wanted us to go to Ohio because MITRE company wanted to send us to Ohio. For some reason, they didn't want us to go where I took you in the book.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's really interesting, all these connections that I found. Now, there was another thing interesting about this 9B character. He married a woman from Europe, and she moved to Israel, too, when she was in her teens. And then they moved to the Boston area, where he started this communications company. One of the things I found is that almost all of the people that became heroes on Flight 93, mm-hmm. And people that I believe were, in fact, handlers, not victims, were involved in some form of communications. And United Airlines in Chicago that morning lost their phone lines and their email ability. And so I found this was kind of interesting, that people always asked me, well, how come those planes weren't full? Had those planes been full, you would have had nearly 800,
right.
give or take 25.
Mm-hmm.
Each plane carries around roughly 200, some a little more. The 76 a little bit more, and the 75s are a little under 200. They're usually around 180, depending upon the configuration.
Mm-hmm.
And so just roughly estimate 200, you got 800 passengers. We only had about just under 250 passengers and crew that needed to be taken care of, as we should say, instead of 800. So we see all these people that are involved with this into the communications, and I'm talking telephone and internet. So I think that reservations was probably commandeered. So that those planes were no longer shown available on reservations. It would have been real easy for a lot of these people that we think are heroes or victims on that day to do, because they were all involved in companies, and MITRE company could do
it. Right.
So there was lots of ability, and that's probably why it was done. I mean, 800 people, that's nearly 1,000 people. That's 2 747s full of people. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I look at things. You know, what kind of aircraft have I worked? 800 people, that's 2 747s full. So you see, that's probably why that was done, and that makes sense, because all the flights were operating full. I mean, it's one of the things I thought, well, how'd they get an airplane with only 33 people on board?
Right.
You know, it was like, oh, okay. Well, so later on I did find out that there are all these people were connected with that. But 9B, there's an interesting story in the book about his wife as well. And so I found two women involved, and I included them. This divine touch I told you about,
mm-hmm.
when I was in final edit, and there are some spelling errors. The second edition should be up and running here in the next week or so. And everything, I think all my spelling errors are fixed. Most people don't see them because they're so busy reading the story, but you know, some people have ripped me apart.
They're few and far between.
Some people have gotten very angry about it to me. It's really weird, their reaction. But, right. You know, hey, I didn't say I was an author. I guess I am now. But
you are now. Absolutely.
But, yeah, it's just really weird that the things I found. So I wrote that in. I was in final edit. The book was not even a week from getting on Amazon. And I got up and I'm reading an FBI document until the wee hours of the morning. And I find this story about 9B's wife, and it's in an FBI document. And that's every detail that's in there about her asking for her cell phone company to pull a message that was not left in English.
Right.
I don't want to give away too much of the story, but I find this is really interesting because 9B's wife has a very heavy accent.
Mm-hmm.
And she calls her VoiceStream was her cell phone company and asked to have a message that was a recorded message left and make a copy of it. And when the operator, she told the operator that her husband was on flight 11, that he was killed. She pulled up her phone log and she hadn't made any phone calls at all in or out that day after her husband had been killed on flight 11. The gal thought that was very odd, and so do I.
Yes, I would too.
And so when that story in the book comes out about the purser that had a phone call left on her message recorder at 9:51 a.m. that morning, that is a real story from an FBI document, and that's frightening. So that tells me, again, the FBI covered up these women. Have you queued up CeCe Lyle?
I have it right here. Let's do it right now. You want to preface it? We've only got 2 minutes left, so preface it really quick. What are we listening for?
Here it is. CeCe Lyle's called her husband from Flight 93 about 15 minutes before impact, and after her call, she hands the phone to someone, and it's a woman's voice, and at the end of this call you'll hear the woman say, "You did great."
Yes,
there you go,
in a whisper. I'm gonna do it right now. Give it just a second here and it'll kick on. Hopefully it'll be nice and loud.
Tuesday, 9:47 a.m.
Hi, baby. You have to listen to me carefully. I'm on a plane that's been hijacked. I'm on the plane. I'm calling from the plane. I want to tell you I love you. Please tell my children that I love them very much. And I'm so sorry, babe. I don't know what to say. There are three guys. They've hijacked the plane. I'm trying to be calm. We're turned around, and I've heard that there's planes that have been flown into the World Trade Center. I hope to be able to see your face again, baby. I love you. Bye.
Oh. That gives me chills. You can hear that woman at the end say, "You did great."
That's correct. And at the time, that plane was coming out of the sky 6 to 10,000 feet per minute.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would not have a flight attendant, one, be told she did great because she would be in control.
Right.
And two, she would be strapped in somewhere and you would hear passengers screaming
there
in the background.
People would be chaos in the background.
Yes, there would.
She would not be have time to make a normal, you know, normal voice phone call like that. I absolutely 100% agree. Unfortunately, Rebecca, we are out of time. I just want to thank you again for being so brave to put this book out. I highly recommend it. Ladies and gentlemen, please, methodicalillusion.com. Go there and check this book out. This is going to be a bestseller. I can tell you right now. Rebecca, thank you very much for joining us again on the Red Pill Reports. We hope to have you back in the future, especially when the second edition comes out.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Everybody take care. Tomorrow, Kristen Shiri Geo will be our guests. Please get this book. I'm telling you, I can't recommend this book, Methodical Illusion, enough. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Everybody take care. Roger Sales, new show, will be up right next. So keep it right here, wherever you are. Make a TFR, guys. We'll see you guys tomorrow. Take care, everybody.
Truth Frequency Radio is your number one source for news and information. Without the hate, hype, and fear, we are proud to bring you cutting-edge programs like The Kev Baker Show,
The Christopher Everard Show,
The Freedom Link with Joe Joseph,
Truth Frequency with Chris and Shuri Geo,
Red Pill Reports
with J.D. Moore,
X-Squared with Brooks Agnew,
Down the Rabbit Hole with Popeye,
Freaky Friday
with The Woo Crew,
Waking Up the Masses
with Robert Bruce,
Phoenix Rising Radio,
and dozens more.
Did you know you can listen from any any computer, mobile device, or from any telephone by dialing 832-225-5308.
Or call into your favorite show toll-free at 866-37-TRUE.
Uncensored talk and news you won't hear in the mainstream media.
24 hours a day.
Truth Frequency Radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.